This is the story of Leland Haywood, Hollywood's suave actor's agent, the man who represented such superstars as Garbo, Lombard, Lawton, Hepburn, Fonda, Stewart, Peck, Bergman, Niven, Astaire, and Rogers, until the day he turned theatrical producer and hired an agent of his own. Winston Churchill MP, whose mother, Pamela Churchill, married Leland Haywood in 1960, says of the late showman,
"For me, he epitomized the American gentleman."
Ginger Rogers calls him
"the very warm, happy, very gentlemanly gentleman."
And Henry Fonda agrees.
"He was a gentleman. He was known to be a gentleman. He acted like a gentleman."
Of course, and composer Julie Stein joins in the chorus.
"Leland Haywood was a gentleman to the end. A gentleman in every sense of the word. A gentleman and a gentleman."
And he had good judgment, too. Leland Haywood scored a hit with his very first musical when, in association with Joshua Logan and Rodgers and Hammerstein, he presented South Pacific.
"I'm as corny as Kansas in August. I'm as normal as blueberry pie. No more a smart little girl with no heart. I have found me a wonderful guy. I am in the conventional dither with the conventional star in my eye. And you will note there's a lump in my throat when I speak of that wonderful guy. I'm as trite and as gay as a daisy in May, a cliche coming true. I'm bromidic and bright as a moon at the night, pouring light on the dew. I'm as corny as Kansas in August, high as a flag on the 4th of July. If you'll excuse an expression I use, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love with a wonderful guy."
Now, before we go any further, let's please establish that despite the frequent use of the word gentleman to describe Leland Haywood, he was anything but a bloodless, pallid goody-goody. His friend, Billy Wilder, would second that.
"If they had color radio, this would be the appropriate moment, for indeed he was one of the most colorful men I had ever encountered. He had style, he had guts, he had a presence, he had a quality about him."
He also had four wives, one of whom he married twice. The first Mrs. Haywood was a Texas socialite and amateur flyer called Lola Gibbs. They married in 1921, divorced in 1922, remarried in 1930, and divorced again 4 years later. Next, he married the actress Margaret Sullivan, then Nancy Hawkes, and finally, Pamela Churchill, the daughter-in-law of Sir Winston, who today is Mrs. W. Averill Harriman. Now, here's the director-writer, Joshua Logan, a longtime friend and associate of Leland Haywood's, to fill in a bit more background.
"He went to Princeton, which is the same college I went to, and I think he left a little sooner than I did. I mean, he only stayed there a few months. I mean, he couldn't stand the idea of being there. Leland somehow was able to sell anybody anything. I'm sure there's the old thing, he could have sold fridges to the Eskimos, because he was that kind of a tail spinner, yarn spinner.
He even sold himself to the United Artists Film Company as a traveling press agent. His job was to supply editors and cinema managers with photographs of the United Artists stars, Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks Sr. But his bosses learned that he was writing articles about rival stars for a film magazine, and he got the sack. Well, he was in and out of 20 more film jobs before becoming a theatrical agent.
"The first people Leland Haywood had under his wing were Fred and Adele Astaire. He said, 'Would you like to dance at a supper club and get $5,000 a night?' Well, of course, they couldn't say no. And he got them $5,000 per night and became an agent."
Leland Haywood was born in 1902 in Nebraska City, Nebraska. the only son of Colonel William Hayward, a noted lawyer who gained fame during World War I as the commanding officer of the 369th Infantry, the first all-black regiment in the United States Army. Colonel Hayward was a celebrity, and in the days when Leland was Hollywood's toughest agent, making the film moguls' lives miserable, he found that even Sam Goldwyn knew his father. Says Pamela Harriman.
And I remember him telling me that Sam would call him into his office and say, "Leland, you know your father's a great friend of mine, and he's a very fine fella. Now, you know your father's a fine fella." He'd say, "Yes, sir." "Well," says Goldwyn, "can you explain to me how such a fine fella can have such a son of a bitch of a son?"
When Joshua Logan became one of Leland Hayward's clients, his only previous Hollywood job had been as dialogue director on the Charles Boyer Marlene Dietrich film The Garden of Allah. One day, Hayward told Logan that the film producer, Walter Wanger, was interested in hiring him.
So I went over and went into Mr. Wanger's office, escorted in quickly by his secretary, and there was Wanger sitting back, like all movie producers are described, you know, with a polo suit on, you know, polo outfit, uniform, boots and a polo mallet leaning back. And Hayward was lying flat on the couch with a pillow over his face. And Wanger suddenly said to me, "What good are you to me? What can I do with you? You theater guild fellows can't teach us anything out here. Why should I give you a job?" I said, "Well, I haven't the slightest idea why you should give me a job, Mr. Wanger. I'm very sorry I'm here. It's just that Mr. Hayward," and I looked over to Leland, kind of looking at him, trying to signal him to say something. And Leland sort of uncoiled from the couch and said, "Maybe you could give him a job in the cutting room, and he'd learn something that way. You could teach him the business that way." He says, "This isn't any school," says Wanger. "No," he said, "I'm not teaching people. I pay people that's supposed to know their business." "No, no, sir, no, not at all." And I started out asking Leland to go with me. And Wanger said, "Well, of course, you have been a dialogue director on The Garden of Allah, so maybe if Charles Boyer plays Wuthering Heights, which I'm thinking of doing next year, I might be able to use you as a dialogue director. But that's the only thing I can possibly think of for you." And I said, "Well, I understand that. Thank you very much, Mr. Wanger." And I left, blushing. And Leland came with me. And when the door closed, he turned to me and said, "See, he's crazy about you." Now, that was Leland's technique. Kind of. Everything was perfectly all right.
Hayward sold Henry Fonda to the same producer.
He was a super salesman. He was a very persuasive man. And I found myself shaking hands with Walter Wanger to do two pictures a year for him at an incredible amount of money that I didn't think existed. And after Wanger left, I sort of looked at Leland and felt there'd been a big mistake. And he never let me forget. I said, "How can we get out of it?" I thought there had to be something wrong. Anyway, from that day, he was my agent.
When the sky is a bright canary yellow, I forget every cloud I've ever seen. So they call me a cockeyed optimist, immature and incurably green. I have heard people rant and rave and bellow that we're done and we might as well be dead. But I'm only a cockeyed optimist, and I can't get it into my head. I hear the human race is falling on its face and hasn't very far to go. But every whippoorwill is selling me a bill and telling me it just ain't so. I could say life is just a bowl of jello and appear more intelligent and smart, but I'm stuck like a dope with a thing called hope, and I can't get it out of my heart.
It would seem that Leland Hayward was also an optimist, because one day he suddenly upped and quit the agency business and picked up a quick $1 million selling his glamorous clients to an agency called MCA, the Music Corporation of America. Q Kitty Carlisle, who knew Hayward in his agent days, feels that the change to theatrical producer was inevitable.
In a way, it was normal that he got into the theater because he was larger than life. It sort of fitted him. His looks didn't hurt. The fact that he was terribly good looking. He had an extraordinary gift for dealing with people, which is what a producer must have. He managed to combine the elements. He managed to make it work. He obviously brought out the best in people because you have to look at his hits.
And the first of those hits was his first production, the play A Bell for Adarno. It was followed happily by two more of the same, State of the Union and Henry Fonda's great post-war success, Mr. Roberts.
He called me and asked me if I'd read Mr. Roberts, the book, and I said, yes, I had. He said, well, I bought it, and I'm going to do a play about it. I said, really? I didn't think there was a play. I said, I loved the book, but I couldn't believe that was a play. Subsequently, I went to New York to see Josh Logan about something else, and I got there the day that Josh had finished writing the play with Tom Hagen. He read me the play. He didn't let me read it. He read it out loud. And I called Leland immediately, and I said, Leland, I just heard the most beautiful play I've ever heard in the world, and I was committed to a picture out here. And I said, you're the producer of this play. It's up to you to get me sprung from the picture that I'm committed to. So Lou Wasserman and I met with the producer and director of the picture that I was committed to. And Lou Wasserman did such a brilliant job that they, with tears in their eyes, thanked him at the end for letting them out of the contract. I don't know how he did it, but that's how I got away and went back to do Mr. Roberts, which Leland was the producer of.
Hayward's ex-lawyer, John F. Wharton, wrote in his recent book, Life Among the Playwrights,
what I remember most about his first venture was his ambition never to have a New York failure. He closed one very interesting play out of town because he felt the tryout notices augured ill for it in New York.
But Hayward's fellow producer, Irene Selznick, praised him recently in these words.
Leland Hayward was president of the League of New York Theaters, which is an association of theater owners and producers. We negotiated the contracts of the various guilds and unions, set the policies for Broadway, and Leland worked very hard at it for the general good of the theater. He was the best president they ever had. There was a superstition that anyone who was president would have an enormous hit before the end of his term. Leland kept kidding about it, and before the end of his term, he had South Pacific. Everyone was delighted.
Joshua Logan had a lot to do with the vast success of South Pacific, because not only did he co-produce the show, he also directed it and collaborated with Oscar Hammerstein on the libretto. The project started about the same time that Logan and Hayward were preparing Mr. Roberts.
We had dinner one night with Kenneth McKenna, who was at that time the story editor of MGM. And he said, you all are going out to have a vacation before you start Mr. Roberts. I suggest that you read a book that all the studios have turned down because it's too much about the war. He said it's called Tales of the South Pacific. And Leland and his wife at that time was Nancy Hawks, and I flew to Miami. And I started to read one of these stories. And I was so thrilled about it that I decided to keep terribly quiet and not let anybody know about it, because I wanted to see whether I wanted to buy it myself, or I didn't want anybody to be my partner or anything. And I went to breakfast the next morning, having read a little bit more of it in the early morning, and Leland said, what have you been reading? You've got a look on your face like you've been reading something you like. And I said, no, nothing. I'm just going to eat. That afternoon, I took a nap, and I was reading it again, and I went to sleep. And when I woke up, it was an hour and a half later, and I went in the living room. The book was gone, and Leland was just finishing it. He was a very, very fast reader. And he got up and he said, we've got to buy this. We're going to have, you know. Well, of course, you know, he didn't have anything to do with it, but still, he was my partner. And that, of course, had perhaps the greatest score ever written.
Some enchanted evening, you
South Pacific, a show based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, itself won the Pulitzer Prize for drama, only the second time that a musical had ever been awarded one. A year after South Pacific, Leland Haywood presented yet another hit, and this one came about during a chat between Ethel Merman and the writer Howard Lindsay. Lindsay suddenly shouted, "I've got a great idea for a musical for you, Pearl Mester." And Merman shouted back, "Who's Pearl Mester?" Lindsay's answer was, "Tell you later." After which he rushed off to phone his partner, Russell Crouse. Now, Pearl Mester was an American socialite appointed by President Truman as ambassadress to Luxembourg. After Lindsay and Crouse had agreed on the story and Merman had learned the identity of the lady she was going to play, the show went full steam ahead. Leland Haywood agreed to produce, RCA Victor Records decided that they'd provide the $250,000 necessary to back it, and Irving Berlin signed up to write the songs. Now, like Merman, Berlin was a bit hazy about Madame Mester, but once he'd done his homework, he came up with a song about her which filled the bill marvelously.
I'm the chosen party giver for the White House clientele, and they know that I deliver what it takes to make 'em gel. And in Washington, I'm known by one and all as the hostess with the mostest on the ball. Elsa Maxwell, when they had an axe to grind, they could always grind their axe well at the party she designed. Now the hatchet grinders all prefer to call on the hostess with the mostest on the ball. I've a great big bar and good caviar, yes, the best that can be found, and a large amount in my bank account when election time comes round. If you're feeling presidential, you can make it, yes indeed. There are just three things essential, let me tell you all you need, is an ounce of wisdom and a pound of gold. And the hostess with the mostess on the ball. Entertaining vodka drinkers is a job they give to me. Making nice guys out of stinkers seems to be my cup of tea. What they really need behind the iron wall is the hostess with the mostest on the ball. There's regulations as to who sits next to who. But there might be complications when the blue blood's not so blue. So the priestess with the leastest protocol is the hostess with the mostest on the ball. An ambassador has just reached the shore. He's a man of many loves. An important gent from the Orient to be handled with kid gloves. He can come and let his hair down, ooh, have the best time of his life. Even bring his new affair down, introduce her as his wife. But she mustn't leave her panties in the hall of the priestess with the leastest, nor the hostess with the mostest, with the mostest on the
The choreographer of the new show was the marvelously skillful Jerome Robbins.
I first met him on a show called Call Me Madam. He was tall, personable, lots of charm, but there was something about his directness that appealed to me immediately. At one point in New Haven, a whole dance number of mine had to come out of the show, and he took me for a walk and told me this. And he was so direct about it and so nice about it that it was a painless thing for me and a man-to-man thing, which was quite in contrast with what usually happened on the show, where people would be devious or soap you before or be ruthless about it.
When the new Merman show hit Broadway, the critics sent out for fresh superlatives. Wrote Brooks Atkinson in the New York Times,
"The music of Call Me Madam is cheerful and intimate, and the lyrics are effortless and amusing. Over the years, Mr. Berlin has probably written a number of songs in the casual vein of It's a Lovely Day Today, but none of them has ever been more enchanting.
It's a lovely day today, so whatever you've got to do, you've got a lovely day to do it in, that's true. And I hope whatever you've got to do is something that can be done by two, for I'd really like to stay. It's a lovely day today, and whatever you've got to do, I'd be so happy to be doing it with you. But if you've got something that must be done, and it can only be done by one, there is nothing more to say, except it's a lovely day for saying it's a lovely day.
Ethel Merman is just one of the countless women who adored Leland Haywood. She wrote in her autobiography,
"When Call Me Madam went to Washington for a four-week engagement after the Broadway run, Leland had an entire new wardrobe made for me. And when I left the show in Washington, he made me a present of all those dresses. People tell you that Haywood was a big man. Well, I can tell you how big."
The Catskill Mountains of Upper New York State are famous for two things, Rip Van Winkle and the Jewish summer camp. In the 1930s, Arthur Kober wrote a play about one of these resorts called Having Wonderful Time. Many years later, he decided it had the makings of a musical and sought out the songwriter Harold Rome.
I immediately responded to it because, after all, I'd gotten my first job in the theater in a summer camp, a bit like the one he wrote about in Having Wonderful Time, and this was the chance to get it all out of my system. We worked on it for 9 months. Then we got Josh Logan in and started all over again.
We started with a story about a Jewish camp in the Catskills. Young people going up there to see if they can find a mate. Stenographers and switchboard girls go up and meet young law students and doctors who are waiting on tables, and then they have to dance with the girls at night by changing coats. And it's a cute little atmosphere. And Harold Rome had written a wonderful score for it, including that great song, Wish You Were Here. And Leland is such a terrible snob. How will he look on the Catskills, you know? He will never want to have anything to do with that, you see. He wouldn't want his name associated with him. So I thought of a wonderful way of snagging him. I said, why don't we dig a hole in the stage and put in a swimming pool? The moment I told that to Leland, he wanted to do it. He thought it was a great, great idea. The idea of all those girls in wet bathing suits walking around was very exciting, too.
Well, thanks to wet bathing suits, Haywood was hooked. And work proceeded on Wish You Were Here.
They're not making the skies as blue this year. Wish you were here. As blue as they used to when you were near. Wish you were here. And the mornings don't seem as new, brand new as they did with you. Wish you were here. Wish you were here. Wish you were here. Someone's painting the leaves all wrong this year. Wish you were here. And why did the birds change their song this year? Wish you were here. They're not shining the stars as bright. They've stolen the joy from the night. Wish you were here. Wish you were here. Wish you were here.
When Wish You Were Here opened in New York, business was poor, but Joshua Logan was convinced that it could and would be a hit. He did considerable work on it, and after a few weeks, business picked up, and it subsequently ran on Broadway for 2 years. It was almost another 7 years before Haywood found another stage property that he wanted to present. So he went back to Hollywood, this time as a film producer. His first production was the screen version of his play, Mr. Roberts. Next, he signed his old friend and ex-client, Jimmy Stewart, to star in The Spirit of St. Louis, a film based on the epic Atlantic fight of Charles A. Lindbergh, says Winston Churchill.
A very enthusiastic aviator in his early years, and with the coming of the Second World War, with a friend, he established a flight training school for pilots called Thunderbird Field outside Phoenix, Arizona. And there are many hundreds of RAF pilots did their initial combat training. And Leland used to tell with some regret how, at the end of the war, he and his friend, who'd bought not only airfield, but 50 or 100 acres around the airfield, which was desert, worth virtually nothing, sold up. And that, of course, is now part of the heart of downtown Phoenix, which has, since the war, been the fastest growing city in the world. And the land values don't even bear consideration.
Oh, well, win some, lose some. The Spirit of St. Louis was directed by the brilliant Billy Wilder.
Not a very successful picture. People kind of try to comfort me sometimes with lines like ahead of its time, but I guess it just wasn't much good and people were not much interested in it. It was a technically very difficult picture. It cost us a great deal of pain. We were working on it for a year, year and a half, and the rewards were very slim indeed.
Wilder and Haywood had been associated long before The Spirit of St. Louis. Over 20 years earlier, Wilder had been a Haywood client.
Now, as for his power as an agent, I remember the day had come where I decided I would like to direct. It was very difficult to get in those days because there was no schooling, there was no television where you could be tested in rather inexpensive half-hour shows, say. They had to entrust you with what was then an enormous amount of money, say $1 million, to go and make a picture, especially a writer, not even a cutter who knew his way around, or a cameraman, or a relative. I was none of those things. He just swung the deal, and then the question was, who is to play the lead? And within 15 minutes, he got Ginger Rogers, who had just won the Academy Award for Kitty Foyle, to play the lead. The name of the picture, it was the first picture I ever acted, was the Major and the Minor, which is no problem for him at all. He really wielded enormous authority.
However, a few years later, Haywood tried unsuccessfully to talk Billy Wilder out of making The Lost Weekend, a film which was to win a whole shelf full of Oscars. And then there was the lapse that Ginger Rogers never let him forget.
My mother asked him when she was going to go and do my new contract at RKO. She said to him, Leland, please be sure that you get in Ginger's new contract anything that has to do with television involved in the contract, so that a percentage of whatever is going to be done for television will come to her out of the films that she will make on this contract. And he said, Leela, television isn't here yet. It's not going to be anything, and you and I will be in our grave before it ever gets to be anything. And he said, if you think I'm going to jeopardize Ginger's contract by asking for such a nothing. I have talked to Leland after this terrible mistake he made. He was very red-faced about it, and whenever I was in a party and I'd say, tell them, Leland, how you got me a percentage of television in my contract with RKO, tell them about it. And he would put his hands over his head as though bricks were falling on his head. And he'd say, oh, no, not again. Don't bring that up.
Ironically, it was in television, the medium Hayward never thought would be anything, that he had some of his greatest successes.
It was very hard for people to refuse Leland anything. I mean, I remember in the Ford 50th anniversary show, which I suppose was the first really big musical television spectacular, Mary Martin was going to do the girl's part at Our Town, and the actor with her at the last minute fell out. And Leland got hold of Oscar Hammerstein to read from Our Town, and it was absolutely marvelous. He also, in that particular show, got a wonderful duet with Ethel Merman and Mary Martin. Well, in a sense, they were rivals, and it was extraordinary to be able to get them to do a duet. And it was one of the highlights of the show.
Mary, let's sing some I songs.
Like,
I cried for you.
And I'm forever blowing bubbles.
And I'm always chasing rainbows.
And I'm in the mood for love.
And I'm the brave. I'd climb the highest mountain if I knew.
The dances for that memorable Ford 50th anniversary show were choreographed by Jerome Robbins.
It was really the first of the spectaculars, and Leland had this idea of putting a show together that would run, I think, 2 hours, to be broadcast over our two largest networks at the same time, CBS and NBC. I worked very, very closely with him on that, even though I was responsible only for the staging of the musical numbers and the choreography. We'd get into his office and push things around, and Leland was the kind of man where you could just say, oh, come on, I think that stinks, or, geez, I think that's great. And we could play that back and forth between each other very easily. At one point, when we were doing technical rehearsals of that show, something was not prepared for one of my numbers that I needed to have, and he started getting very excited. And for the first time, I had to say to him, Leland, calm down, I'll get it done, don't worry, just keep you cool. And we laughed about that quite often. The thing about Leland losing his temper, that it was so open and direct. I mean, I never saw him fling anything around a room. things went wrong or someone loused up or received a disappointment, his reactions were ordinary. He could keep peace and creativity going on all his shows. And as everyone knows, doing a show is always a huge collaborative effort between many kinds of personalities with many kinds of wills. And what Leland was great at particularly was keeping a harmony among all the people and getting them going all the time to move it on.
While we're talking about Leland Haywood's television specials, it's interesting to note that he was the purveyor of the satirical 60s onto the American screens, with the transplant of That Was the Week That Was, which he presented with David Frost. However, it was earlier in the 60s, in fact, on a 1961 radio show, when he was talking to an actor-cum-interviewer named Ronald Reagan about his forthcoming TV production, The Gershwin Years.
We did this kind of an imaginative excerpt from Porgy and Bess. It was a dance. Not like Porgy and Bess has ever been done. And we did it on television tape. And I thought it was just great. And by some terrible thing, half the tape was wiped out. We made the original Porgy and Bess segment in Long Island on Jamaica Bay. And we took a terrible chance because it was December. And we managed to get absolutely beautiful weather, a warm temperature of 62. And then the tape was wiped out. And the next day, the snowstorm came along. And the temperature never got above 30 after that, so we finally had to go to Florida and do it in Key West.
I suspect that when people see the finished version of the show next Sunday night, they'll feel it was worth all the trouble. I've heard great reports, Leland.
Thank you very, very much.
Well, Leland, we've hit another time limit. Will you come back for one more round and bring things up to date? Talk about some of the contemporary repercussions of the Gershwin years?
Love it.
Leland Haywood and I will be resuming this survey of the careers of George and Ira Gershwin on this station a bit later today. Hope you'll be listening for it.
Meanwhile, back on this station.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to have you know what this show is all about. With the title, Mr. President, you've wondered, no doubt, just who it could be. Don't jump to conclusions. It's not who you think. Not the Roosevelts. Not the Trumans. Not the Eisenhowers. No, this is not that kind of show. Not the Kennedys. No, not the Kennedys. Just a family of four. So it could be the Kennedys. With the Kennedys, there'd have to be more than four. Just a simple American, not one of the greats. But he happens to be president of these United States. And now I'd like you to take a glance at a formal, dignified White House dance.
The show, Mr. President, was produced by Leland Haywood in 1962. Time magazine compared the show to the Titanic, saying, "It left port with a glittering credits list on board, Irving Berlin, Leland Haywood, Joshua Logan, and as it plowed through the murky theatrical waters, the iceberg-cool critics put sizable holes in its hull. Mr. President carried a trapped and talented crew that seemed to take comfort in huddling together at the finale to sing an Irving Berlin version of My Country, 'Tis of Thee, called This Is a Great Country.
This is a great country, a great country. So let's shout it clear and loud. Take a look in your history book and you'll see why we should be proud. Hats off to America, the home of the free and the brave. If this is flag waving, do you know of a better flag to wave? This is a great country, so let's shout it clear and loud. Take a look in your history book, and you'll see why we should be proud. That's up to America.
America. The home of the free and the brave. If this is flag waving, do you know us? Father flag to wave. If this is flag waving, do you know us? Father flag to
The new show got off on the wrong foot by opening in the most appropriate and yet also the most inappropriate city possible. Winston Churchill recalls with some pain.
There was one evening when we were opening in Washington with Mr. President, and the President, Jack Kennedy, said that he wanted to come along to the opening performance. And it was only when one had the President himself sitting there in the audience that one realized how the play in many ways applied to this particular president, even though it was conceived on a much more general basis. And many of the comparisons became acutely embarrassing at the time. I remember it was a very awkward evening for everyone.
An opinion shared by Mr. Churchill's mother.
Mr. President was a flop. It was surprising to me because there was so much talent involved. Irving Berlin's music, Lindsay and Krauss did the book, Josh Logan directed it. People were expecting such great things. In my opinion, that was one of the reasons that killed it. If people had never heard of it, they might have been rather kinder towards it. Also, we opened in Washington, which was very difficult because it was a play about a president, and President Kennedy came to the opening night. And that was all full of drama, too, because suddenly around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I got a call from the White House. It was the time of the Bay of Pigs, and so he was terribly occupied, and that it would be impossible for him to see the whole show, which would be better if he came to the first act or the last act. Well, we decided that the last act would be better, because if he came to the first act and then left, everybody would think that he'd walked out on the show. So he did, in fact, come for the last act. I'm no expert, but I have a feeling if Mr. President had been done in the 40s, it might have been quite a success. It was out of its age, and its story was not in tune with the modern. We were getting into the Vietnam era, and people didn't want that type of old-fashioned musical.
Nanette Fabre, who played the First Lady, isn't likely to forget the first night either.
I must say that was probably one of our most interesting, thrilling, interesting is a better word even. The Kennedys and everybody else connected with the Kennedys had taken over the theater in Washington. We were all issued special passes. The Secret Service came in and worked over the theater 3 or 4 hours before anyone arrived. I knew they had been there because my dressing room had never been so neat or so clean or so tidy. Everything was put back in immaculate condition. Even my lipsticks, I could tell, had been opened, examined, and put away all neatly and carefully.
Ah, the little treasures. Anyway, let's turn from Leland Haywood's biggest flop to his biggest hit.
Every path you know, climb every mountain.
Although The Sound of Music was never liked by the critics, the public loved it, and its financial rewards were truly bank-boggling. The stage production grossed $50 million, and the movie version of The Sound of Music has so far grossed $125 million. So, sucks boo to the critics. Originally, Leland Haywood had had long and difficult negotiations with the Baroness von Trapp, who owned the rights of the book on which The Sound of Music was based. Eventually, however, agreement was reached when Leland Haywood suggested that the Baroness could use her profits from the show for some missionary work that she was planning in New Guinea. The deal was made, and Rodgers and Hammerstein began work on the songs.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, odelay, odelay, hee-hoo. Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd, lay, odelay, odeloo. Folks in a town that was quite remote heard, lay, odelay, odelay, hee-hoo. Lusty and clear from the goat herd's throat heard, lay, odelay, odeloo. Oh, oh, lady, odelay, oh, oh. Of a castle moat heard, lay, odelay, odelay, hee-hoo. Men on a road with a load to tote heard, lay, odelay, odeloo. Men in the midst of a table don't heard, lay, odelay, odelay, hee-hoo. Men drinking beer with a foam afloat heard, lay, odelay, odeloo. Oh,
one of the songs from The Sound of Music whose success and popularity is now theatrical history. Leland Haywood died in 1971. In his 27 years as a showman, he presented only 6 Broadway musicals, of which 5 were major hits, plus a co-production with David Merrick in 1965 of a show called Hot September, which was based on the play Picnic. However, Haywood considered his finest musical production to be, well, let's let the composer Julie Stein tell you about that.
We write a show like Gypsy with Sondheim, with Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the libretto. We studied it, and the thing we wrote a work. We wrote a dramatic work. It shows you, done first time in 58, done just now. It's playing even in the summer stock circuit. You know, Angela doing $145,000 a week in stock. People out there, it's a work. It's 10 years from now, maybe Streisand will play it. Because it's forever. Very few are forever. I don't think Fair Lady has the forever quality that Gypsy has.
You be swell. You'll be great. Gonna have the whole world on a plate. Starting here. Starting now. Honey, everything's coming up roses. Clear the decks. Clear the tracks. You got nothing to do but relax. Blow a kiss. Take a bow. Honey, everything's coming up roses. Now's your inning. Stand the world on its ear. Set it.
Hand we
sentiments that could almost sum up the career of Leland Haywood. And for a last word on him, let's hear from Rosalind Russell.
The end of his life came much too soon as far as years go. We miss him, but I think his tradition, what he stood for in the theater, they always used the word with Leland, class. Leland had class. And he gave whatever he did a certain patina that was very, very welcome, and we could use a great deal more of it today.
And a final postscript from Pamela Harriman, quoting a letter from author Irwin Shaw on the occasion of Leland Haywood's death.
He was a marvelous man who had a wonderful life. He was loved. He relished work. He relished play. He knew everybody, was interested in everything, and was at home everywhere. His principles were high, his actions admirable. He was the most dependable of friends. He had success early and late, and enough failure to make him realize how sweet success really could be.
The story of Leland Haywood in the American Showman series was presented by Michael Craig. Research was by Bill Sullivan, the writer Dick Vosborough, and the producer David Raven Allen. Benny Green now has a few words to say.
Well, the impression we're left with by this week's Showman story is that Leland Haywood was a high-powered agent who became a high-powered producer and trod on one or two corns along the way. That's an occupational risk with producers anyway. The very nature of the game they're playing, selling something artistic in the hope of getting rich on it, isn't quite the occupation that endears you to children and dogs. But next week's subject makes Leland Haywood sound like Father Christmas. He is David Merrick, who is, by one of those coincidences, the only showman in this series that I ever met. And what I made of him is, I think, highly relevant to next week's show. In that show, we'll be hearing all sorts of conflicting testimonies about Merrick's cussedness, his mercenary attitude, his ruthlessness, his callousness, and so on. Being a humanist myself, I like to think it all true, and I suspect it just might be. I once presided over a television talk show at which Merrick was a guest. Someone among the other guests made quite a mild remark at which Merrick threatened to get up and leave the studio if he wasn't treated more considerately. For my own part, I heartily wished he had got up and left, but no such luck. He stayed and reigned all over everybody for the rest of the programme, and I mean R-A-I-N-E-D. But Merrick has always been a dealer in the best music.
What kind of fool am I who never fell in love? It seems that I'm the only one that I have been thinking of. What kind of man is this? An empty shell, a lonely cell in which an empty heart must dwell. What kind of clown am I? What do I know of life? Why can't I cast away this mask of play and live my life? Why can't I fall in love like any other man? And maybe then I'll know what kind of fool I am.
What kind of fool am I comes, of course, from Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, one of the many David Merrick production successes. But there are two things which will come out of the episodes in this series which treat David Merrick's career. The first is that he doesn't seem to be the sort of man who particularly cares if people like him or not. The second thing is, he's always expressed his ruthlessness as a showman with a certain salty sense of humour. Now, I don't think it's the kind of humour that anyone has enjoyed being on the wrong end of. There's nothing benign about it, but it's very comical to other people. For instance, at some time early on in his professional career, Merrick made the priceless discovery that there's nothing as funny as the truth. Not the truth about yourself, but the truth about other people. Listen to the hilariously honest way he cuts Ezio Pinza down to size.
I had Ezio Pinza, whom I took from the Metropolitan Opera. By that time, his voice had deteriorated to where he wasn't good enough for the Metropolitan, but quite good enough for Broadway.
That's one example among many of David Merrick's supreme mastery of the art of how not to win friends and influence people. And in next week's program, there are others, including the notorious trick he played on the New York critics. That ploy was halfway between a practical joke and a confidence trick. But as the critics in question were at least as dislikable as Merrick was, and perhaps more so, nobody cared, except the critics. Next week, in the first of two shows devoted to this prolific and controversial showman, we'll hear conflicting evidence from Burton Lane and Julie Stein, Carol Channing and Gower Champion, Joshua Logan, Arthur Schwartz, and of course Merrick himself, who will, if he ever sits down and tries to work out who, among all his professional associates, loves him not for his power or his money, but for himself, may end up quoting a song from one of his own productions.
Who can I turn to when nobody needs me? My heart wants to know, and so I must go where destiny leads.